Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And Americans for the Arts.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. When you hear these words, all of Michigan's bars and restaurants will be closed. As per Governor Whitmer's order enacted earlier today, the effort to slow the spread of COVID-19 has moved into the service industry. Many locations can still provide takeout, but as for dining in person, that's done for the foreseeable future. Please remember that if you need to know the latest, Michigan Radio is working hard to keep our website up to date. Many of the questions you may have right now can be answered there. But first, just like that, Michigan's kids have become homeschoolers. Since the governor ordered schools closed last week, educators, parents, and students find themselves in an unprecedented situation. They're implementing distance learning, home study, and remote student services virtually on the fly. Rick Heitmeyer is the superintendent of Baldwin Community Schools. He joins us now by Skype. Rick, hi there.
Hi.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about what the parent reaction was when you announced that classes would be canceled?
Well, I think that the governor beat us before we were able to announce it. So I think a lot of people knew going into Friday what was coming. So, you know, we were hopeful that we would have enough kids there to even count Friday after the big announcement at 11 o'clock on Thursday night. And we did have enough. But you know, I think people were just surprised. Some people were a little bit nervous.
For sure. Would you say that what's happening right now feels very real yet for folks in Western Michigan?
This is so surreal. You know, it's hard to explain. It's just really interesting, really eerie, actually.
For sure. Many districts have had concerns about how families that experience food insecurity might do during an extended break like this. What has Baldwin's strategy been for kids who are normally relying on school breakfast and school lunches?
We looked at a few different options, and what we ended up doing is we have three school vans, and we are going to three different areas in our district. And we are handing out breakfast and lunch at 9:30 in the morning. We're actually doing multiple days in one day, but we just want people to know that we do have food available and we're there to make sure they get it, because that's one of our biggest fears from the beginning is, if this is going to happen, how are we going to make sure that all these kids we feed every day can still eat?
Meaning to say, those who are able to get the drop-offs will get multiple days' meals in one delivery, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Sure. I know that there's a lot going on right now, but what are your concerns about the need to stay on schedule? I don't even know if you're there yet, but many, many schools are on a pretty strict regime for the stuff kids need to learn so that they can be tested when the time comes. Do you have any idea about what this is going to mean for academics?
Well, that is a huge concern because, you know, there's a lot of research that says when you miss one day of school, it's bad. You miss 10 days, it's worse. Now, you know, we're going to miss we don't know how many days. For us right now, it's 5 days, and then we actually were going into what we call intercession and then spring break. So right now we're only losing 5 days of instruction. But if this gets stretched out longer, then it's going to be multiple days. And, you know, I don't know how or when they'll be able to be made up. But you're certainly looking at kids being, you know, set back academically.
Are there different concerns for your elementary age kids and for your middle and high schoolers?
Yeah, I mean, there's different concerns, more or less. You know, they're going to miss academic time. They're not going to learn. But your older kids, your seniors, you know, if this somehow gets extended, you know, through, say, June, you know, I think that they still graduate, but they haven't completed everything. So how does that work? You know, those are questions that we're really going to need some guidance on, because this is so unprecedented. But, you know, kids are losing learning time.
For sure.
So, you know, do our third graders move to fourth grade, or do we have some academy at the start of the next school year where you spend 6 weeks making sure that you finish up the previous grade? I don't know what it's going to look like, and those answers aren't out there. So it's going to be some deep thinking about how we make sure we fill some gaps, because we already deal with gaps all the time.
Rick, what will your school staffs be doing during this period? I imagine a lot of them do have kids of their own.
I imagine that a lot of staff members will be working with their own kids. Some of my staff is staying in touch with their kids. We at the secondary level, we set up Google Classrooms. So I know that teachers are going to be giving out different assignments and looking at those assignments. I know that the elementary teachers were finding ways to keep in touch with kids, sending home lots of books and materials. So, you know, since we had about a day to prepare for this, I'm really pleased with the way the staff at Baldwin was able to put things together and give things to kids to work on during however long the extended break might be.
We've been speaking with the superintendent of Baldwin Community Schools, Rick Heitmeyer. Rick, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Let's turn now to another of Michigan's districts. Renee Garcia is the superintendent of Muskegon Heights Schools. Mrs. Garcia, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
How are you holding up?
We're getting through it. It's a journey.
What were principals and teachers and maybe parents' top line concerns about sending kids home?
You know, I think our greatest concerns in our community is one, just to, first of all, make sure that we're taking care of basic needs. There's a lot of anxiousness around this, so we want to be able to figure out how we can talk best with kids and help calm them and then take care of needs, for example, food.
Right. Well, what did you decide about meeting students' nutritional needs over time?
So what we did was we followed the format that was put out by the Michigan Department of Education, that we can put out 2 meals a day, 7 days a week. So that's a pretty exciting opportunity. And we started this morning. We had 1,000 breakfasts and 1,000 lunches prepared, which will give us 500 students 2 days worth of meals. And then we sent bus loads out to our community. We have 42 bus stops in our community, and we put out a schedule, and I'm just getting feedback now of parents, you know, wondering which bus or which stop, trying to direct people. If you go 2 blocks this way and 1 block that way, you're going to catch the next bus in 5 minutes. And so people are going out and picking up their lunches, and everything seems to be going really well.
So putting the school buses to work for this, I like that approach. What were the discussions like about how much contact there'll be between students and teachers over the extended break?
So that's the next part that we're working on right now. Today we've asked all of our teachers to call each of their students. So at the elementary level, it's their regular homeroom class. At the secondary level, we have an advisory period, so we ask the teachers to call that class list. And what they're doing today is they're just reaching out and saying, hey, this is kind of weird, right? But we're going to figure it out together. And then they're asking about their internet access. So do they have Wi-Fi? Do they have a device that they can use? And if the answers to that are no, then they're helping them problem solve it. There's some great programs out there. Comcast was the first to reach out to us, so we're recommending that. Kids can sign up, or families can sign up, for 60 days for free. And so we're helping them helping them get connected to that. And then the next step, if they're missing a device, is to kind of get an idea of how many people are in the house, what age level the child is. If they're younger, they could probably work with a tablet. If they're older, they might need a Chromebook. And we'll take a look at what the needs are and what our current inventory at school is, and then see what we can do. And perhaps later this week, when we're delivering lunches, we might be delivering some devices as well.
I know a lot of this is just getting worked out, but does it seem to make more sense to let teachers work this out class by class, or to try to have some sort of policy that the whole district can look at and try to put into place?
So I guess we're doing a little bit of both. So we're trying to take a district systematic approach, but then asking the teachers to make those connections because they have the relationships built with the kids, right? Just like we know that change really happens and the work really happens with the teacher in the classroom, that's where we're going to see the greatest impact here between the teacher and the classroom. And then we're fortunate to have a number of coaches and instructional assistants and other support staff on our team. And we're asking them to make that specialist of who they think they've got great relationships with. And then they're going to follow back up and do some additional phone contacts. So I don't think we can reach out too much, and especially with the people that have made that relationship and connection with the kids.
Are a lot of people asking you whether the school year is going to be extended?
I'm starting to hear that question, yes. And my solid answer is I have no idea. We'll wait to see.
I mean, does that depend on how many days students end up missing?
Yeah, it takes the legislature to change if we're going to have less than 180 days of instruction. Last year, they did that because of all those crazy snow days, right?
Right.
So we'll wait and see. This year is a very different event, but we'll wait and see what they tell us we need to do.
Renee Garcia is the superintendent of Muskegon Heights Schools. Mrs. Garcia, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Pastor Tim Ziegler.
Over the weekend, pastors, rabbis, imams, faith leaders of all descriptions did something many of them have never done before. They preached to their congregants online. This is United Methodist Pastor Tim Ziegler in Ann Arbor preaching from the virtual pulpit.
And so maybe you'd like to use the comment section here on YouTube, or perhaps use your phone or another device to take a couple of notes.
This is just wild. Last week, we spoke with several faith leaders about their struggle to both protect the public and also engage with their congregants and provide them comfort in a time of distress and, for many, a time of need. Those conversations were preempted by President Trump's press conference last week. We hope you can still go listen to them. They're up right now at michiganradio.org.
Let us be well. Let us love our neighbors. And let us continue to sing songs of hope and joy, even in times like this.
You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Governor Gretchen Whitmer is shutting down privately owned casinos in Detroit temporarily to fight against the spread of coronavirus. She's also banned gatherings of 250 people or more, but her ban does not apply to the casinos owned by Native American tribes. They're sovereign nations. Some tribes have voluntarily closed casinos, but this is a complicated decision since some rely on the revenue to fund their government. Interlochen Public Radio's Kay LaFond has more.
The Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians is the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River, with 44,000 citizens. Austin Lowe's is one of those citizens, and he wants his tribe to consider closing their casinos in response to the coronavirus outbreak.
Medical experts strongly recommend that 250 people or more should not congregate in the same place, and a casino is that to a T. You know, it's a place where people go, germs are spread.
He wants quick action. He's seen what's happening in Italy. He's seen guidance from the CDC. He knows this could be bad for older adults.
The Sioux tribe has a lot of people in the community who are elders, who are native speakers, and to lose one of those would be absolutely terrible for our culture.
But casino revenue is critical to this tribal government. Tribal Chairman Aaron Payment says casino profits make up an important gap in federal funding.
Our service area population is funded at about 40% of our need, and so we supplement the other 60% with revenue that comes from our casinos.
The money goes to things like the Sioux Tribe's health department, social services, law enforcement, and environmental monitoring.
100% of our net revenues go for services, and right now, it's all allocated.
There could be some relief from the federal government. When President Donald Trump approved $8.3 billion for COVID-19 assistance earlier this month, $40 million of it was set aside for tribes. Aaron Payment wants to know when and how tribes will get that money.
We want to make sure that it is maximally flexible so that tribes can cater those funds to their needs. And so we haven't been able to get an answer from them.
He calls this whole situation unprecedented. The Sioux Tribe is holding a special meeting of its tribal council on Tuesday, where they'll consider closing their casinos. A few miles west along the Lake Superior shoreline, the Bay Mills Indian community has closed the smaller of its two casinos. Chairman Brian Newland told IPR that a full shutdown of both while paying workers would hurt his tribe's ability to provide services. He says they don't have a rainy day fund. He also says it's hard to tell from the outside how shutting down a casino will impact a tribe. It depends on their debt, their cash flow, and how many citizens they're providing for. Up to this point, only one of 11 other tribes in Michigan, the Gun Lake Tribe, has closed a casino. Austin Lowe, the concerned citizen from Sioux Tribe, thinks tribal governments are paying close attention to each other.
If other tribes close their casinos, I could definitely see the Sioux Tribe following suit.
Lowe also thinks no matter what, coronavirus is going to affect the tribe's economy, and that it shows they need to diversify their sources of revenue. I'm Kay LaFond.
The CDC is now recommending against gatherings of 50 people. A few tribal casinos have announced closures today. So far, it's Little River and Bay Mills. There are some things that we understand through facts, and then there are some that we may understand better through feeling. Poet Samaj Brown has spent most of her writing life with a foot in both worlds. In her passionate, evocative poems, the natural world and her community intertwine and connect again and again in surprising ways. As Flint's poet laureate, Brown has formalized her longtime education work while acting as a kind of medium and mirror for Flint's response to its water crisis. She recently published a book, Bleeding Fire, Tap the Eternal Spring of Regenerative Light, Conversations in Poetry and Prose, and we've invited her to talk to us about her work. Samaj Brown, welcome to Stateside.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very excited.
You know, there are a few moments in the preface that have struck me again. I've gone back to that page several times in the past week or so. You write that in difficult times, there's much to do to redeem our world. The cynics say problems have always been here. I answer, you say, so too have solutions. Do you still feel that in this moment right now?
Yes, I do. I do. I feel that in this moment. We have to pull on all of our resources. And that means our spiritual resources, our social resources, our humanity, sometimes our great humanity, that sometimes we just don't tap into on a regular basis because we're on a treadmill and we're doing so many things, task-oriented. So this is a time for us to step out of the skin that we usually wear and become transformative.
The selection of you as Flint's poet laureate is so timely, I feel, in so many ways, considering that you're also deeply concerned with, as you put it, the twirling twins of art and science. And it's something that, I mean, there are many artists who say that these fields both have resonance for them, but you have been breathing this air, I suppose we could say, for a long time. Could you talk a little bit about your grounding in both disciplines, either at Cass Tech or in your sort of adult professional career?
Well, certainly. It really began with my very formative years. So every other night, my mother would read poetry with me, and one night with my sister, one night with me. Poetry was so much a part of my life. I thought the poets were my relatives, poets of Broadside Press, the legacy poets like Audre Lorde and Dudley Randall. They were not my relatives. But as a little girl, they were so frequent in our home. And mother spoke about Gwendolyn Brooks as if she lived right around the corner. So that was my upbringing. And along with that, my grandmother, every year, every summer, we studied in Stratford, Ontario, Shakespeare. And so literary arts were very much a part of my foundation. And then there was a science lab that was in the basement that I could just explore and grow crystals and do experiments. And so science and art melded in my brain. And then attending Cass Tech, we had these different curriculums. And I was in avocational music, which was lots of music, art, and science, and mathematics. So it further reinforced the sameness of those two supposedly disparate disciplines. And I don't see them worlds apart I see them as expressions of the same thing.
May I ask you to read for us?
Certainly. I will read Mother Ocean. And I'd like to give you a little background on Mother Ocean. For a long time here in Flint, once I married my husband, he's a medical doctor, and I started to work with him in the practice. And he asked me, I was going to do science consulting for the Flint Public Schools, and he asked me to help him get the word out by doing the kind of programming I do. And so I started to look at health and art and science and do this professional workshopping I do for his patients and then the community. And then we had a lot of things happen. So we're talking about a period of years, over a decade, where I wasn't writing serious poetry. I was writing curriculum and workshopping. And then the Flint Institute of Arts had an exhibit called Women of a New Tribe. It was an exhibit of African-American women in the community, all in black and white, by Jerry Taliaferro. It was a wonderful installation. That was in 2017. I was one of the subjects. And when the gallery opened, it was so beautiful. It inspired this poem called Mother Ocean, where it's filled with magical realism, where the ocean is personified. And the little river girl speaks to the ocean, and she says, "I talk to the ocean. I ask Mother Ocean, how long after middle passage did it take to heal your daughters, make them whole? How did you shape this distinct, beautiful creation?" And Mother Ocean answers in still serenity. And Mother Ocean says, "It's been 400 years. I sculpted them from promise. They were complete in the beginning, throughout, and remain whole today. Their memory was stolen. Their memory was stolen. Could not remember gold of Benin or family compounds, Acabulan, antiquity birthing science, Moorish, Spain, Timbuktu, world center of trade and scholarship, or origins of iron-forged French Quarter. Could not remember the military brilliance of Queen Nzinga or the original tongues of Fula and Yoruba." Mother Ocean continued. She said, "I fashioned each death new, molded feminine fluid into flesh, pooling ancient memories floating in time. They were recreated from the scarring flow of centuries, formed by amniotic river that pulse their veins. They speak the language of water now, and water is spirit, and spirit remembers. I am the ocean spirit remembering when they cannot." And so the poem has been called an epic poem, an odyssey of African-American history and culture, because it goes on and it goes through middle passage. Mother Ocean receives her daughters on the ocean floor, and she says that she never abandoned them. She was always with them. And they all the way to the Flint water crisis.
The imagery and balance in this work are so amazing. We should mention that a great deal of your work, it can be read on the page, but that you perform. And it's really hearing it read out loud is so essential to the full experience. This poem opens with a pretty essential question, though. How long to heal the wounds of the middle passage? How has poetry helped you with the process of shaping essential questions?
Well, I think poetry helps one to answer essential questions, or at least to clarify them. And so because poetry has the ability to be so intense and condense very complex ideas into a kernel, so that one can look at that kernel and maybe understand it better of whatever is going on.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with Flint's poet laureate, Samaj Brown. Could you talk a little bit about how you've interpreted your role as Flint's poet laureate? You've had some time to work in this capacity now. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the experience has been like and what you feel you've learned from it and have been able to do?
Oh, certainly. So as poet laureate, my charge, every poet laureate has their own charge. And my charge is using poetry to teach literacy, reading and writing, while also incorporating the arts and sciences. So it's what I've been doing all along. So when I was teaching healthcare programming, I would always incorporate the arts and sciences. I really don't know if I can do it any other way. That's the way my brain is fixed. So here as poet laureate, we are making games, lots of fun, because sometimes people have been traumatized by trying to read through the educational system. So instead of saying, oh, I'm going to teach reading and writing and have everyone shut completely down, I said, we're going to play a game. And so I create all of these games around words and give words currency, a value system, and synonyms. Instead of having spelling bees, we're having synonym bees. We're learning the nuances of all these words that have similar meanings, but when during usage, they may really have a huge difference. And so we're building vocabulary so that we can write poems and read poems and express ourselves because of the trauma that our community has experienced. Poetry is very important to allow people to write it out of them. You can literally write your emotions and put them on a piece of paper or on a computer screen. And then you can take them, if you so choose, and put them into performance, or perhaps put them in a book, or leave them there. Sometimes it's best just to leave them there.
And to have said it and to have spoken it and given word to it is enough.
Yes. And it's a way to step out of your experience and leave it there so that you may go on and write something different for yourself. So once you write your experience, and it was a hellish one, right? Mm-hmm. So now you have the power to write a new one. You're able to write your future. Poetry allows you to do that. It allows you to imagine, because without imagination, you don't exist as a human being. So I bring art to the curriculum so students, young and old, can imagine their futures.
Samaj, there's some new data that's just come out within the last day or two from Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha, and she's been looking over neuropsychological assessments and other testing of 174 kids in Flint. And just to summarize the findings, she suggests that more of Flint's kids need more help than we've really known to this point. Does that come as any surprise to you or to people in Flint, do you think?
No. I don't think so. It's a surprise to the probably communities and those listening to us now. But it's not a surprise to me because I'm here and I'm seeing what's going on and we're on the front line. And that's why the Poetry Pod Project is so important to be diffused in so many places all across the city. And we have partners. And the partners understand how important it is. And so the Flint Institute of Arts, along with University of Michigan English Department, to try and help to combat these horrible statistics. Because if we can affect children and people with music and art and poetry and science and combine them all and get them very excited about that, it's nothing. It's you can't, when you have a child that's motivated to learn, oh, your job as an educator is so much easier. So the question is, these children that have been so afflicted, how do we get them motivated to help themselves? Well, you do it through poetry. You do it through games, through making words fun. You teach in light, in color, in art, and you integrate it all together so it really speaks to their world and to a world that they can imagine. So that's critical. So the scores don't surprise me. I'm very aware, and that's why as my initiative, the Poetry Pod Project, that's why it's designed the way it's designed on so many different levels.
Poet Samaj Brown. She's had a long career working with young people and is now Flint's Poet Laureate. We'll have more with her after a break. You're listening to Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. My guest today is Flint Poet Laureate Samaj Brown. Her work often straddles the worlds of art and science, and she frequently addresses a wide range of social issues. One poem from her recent book, Bleeding Fire, directly addresses a generation of girls coming of age in the Me Too era, and it's called Roar. I asked her to tell us about writing it.
So, to put it in context, my work speaks to issues of women and subjugation, as well as human. This is a human issue. So when I think about little girls, or little boys for that matter, when I think about them playing and singing their little songs, and whether they're, back in my day, we did something called hopscotch. But now they do a lot of stepping and slapping. It's very rhythmic. And so what are they saying? So what if they were saying something like ABC, don't touch me. 4, 5, 6, none of your tricks. 7, 8, 9, if I say no, don't cross the line. So I could imagine children just playing, jump roping, and doing their stepping. And in their subconscious mind, they have these little rhymes that they're saying. Number two is, I imitate no one. I am the sole one. I am unique. If you can't see me, then you can't see. Glasses are what you need. Number three, no means hell no. I don't care if you go. In fact, I will leave. I can do as I please because I'm free, free, free.
When I think about girls on the playground and ropes and double dutch, I think about this moment of strength and athleticism and sort of living in one's body that maybe we all see in girls' lives terribly often. And it was just so meaningful to find this image come up again in the poem, and to think about it as not just an isolated moment, but a springboard to further, to a source of strength. What was the physicality of that moment like for you when you were a kid? I should say, I don't know if you were much of a jumper.
Well, we ran and we played a great deal, and we rode our bikes for long distances, and then we would fall off, and we didn't have helmets, and we didn't have knee pads then. We didn't have anything.
Right.
We just got scarred up. It was terrible. But we knew, we really did know how to pick ourselves up, and we knew how to form groups and protect ourselves and stand up for ourselves. And I would like for our girls, because during the Me Too crisis, I heard so many women, young women, they weren't sure about the boundaries. They were confused. And I said, if we started at a young age teaching them with rhyme, explaining the boundaries, and they repeated it over and over again in play. So when perhaps a predator approaches them, they have it right on the tip of their tongue. It's been in their mind for so long, saying it over and over again, playing, that they're able to say, hey, don't touch me. Excuse me. No, absolutely not. So many girls don't know they have that. They haven't developed a voice. And my work is about women and girls having a voice. We must have voices.
You have spent so much time reckoning with the slow motion public health emergencies in Flint. And I mean, I think we can say with a relevance that really goes all throughout Michigan. The world is involved in something a little bit faster now. Do you see that changing your role at all?
I do. Being married to a medical doctor, we talk about it every morning and in the evening. And it's all happening rapidly. And we're talking about how best to protect ourselves. And since he's on the front line, how he can help the people. And my role, because I'm getting a lot of information, is to disseminate that information and to help clarify what's going on my Facebook page, in social media, because there's a lot of misinformation, of course, and not understanding why we must distance ourselves. And sometimes people are feeling put upon and inconvenienced.
One more thing to have to deal with amid everything else. Yeah,
exactly. But if we don't, we deal with this, what we have to deal with will be huge death.
I hope you will continue with all this work well beyond your tenure as Poet Laureate, as you did before you were ever announced. But I also, I kind of wanted to thank your husband, because I read in Bleeding Fire, the book, is that he really encouraged you to not consider your work and not just to publish a book of poetry in the form of just poetry, but it's obvious you two have had a big mutual effect on each other. He sounds like a cool guy.
Yes, you know, I'm going to tell you, if it were not for my husband, we would not have Bleeding Fire. But he came home one day and he said, "Why?" Out of the blue, I think I was cooking dinner. He said, "Why don't you have a book?" And I said, "Well, I do have a book," because I was referring to the story cookbook that I did about all the vegetables, Feasts and Fables from the Planet Kingdom. It turned into a complete theatrical production. And so he said, "No, why don't you have a book featuring your poetry and your curriculum and everything?" And I was, and I write this in the book because it became a blur. All the things I had been doing for the last 20 years, including taking care of ill family members, being direct caregiver, and growing the practice and workshops throughout the city of Flint and just on and on. And I realized why some books aren't written, because sometimes the things in the book are very painful and you have to revisit them and you just really don't want to. But I did. And I'm personally better for it, going through it. And so it's not just a poetry book and it's not just a book of essays. It's a combination where the essays help to contextualize the poems in many cases and give a history and a context. And that's what I think people want, because after all, poetry hasn't been the most accessible art form, if we want to be realistic about this.
This is true.
Right. So there are a lot of people who love art, but don't necessarily care for poetry. But in this book, the poetry is contextualized and the feedback has been enormous. Because people love that, these essays and the context for the poems. And I think it makes it more accessible and friendly. And so I'm very happy for that. And I'm very grateful for my handsome hero.
Well, Samaj Brown, we're really, it feels just a little bit easier to face all the madness of the day, knowing that you two are out there helping us through it in this way. Thank you very much for your time and all of your poetry work.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I've had a great time.
Poet Samaj Brown. Her book, Bleeding Fire, can be found on Amazon. We need a moment to draw your attention to another public health crisis, one we discussed briefly a moment ago with poet Samaj Brown. Tens of thousands of Flint residents were exposed to lead in their drinking water during the Flint water crisis. The most vulnerable to the effects of the crisis were the city's children. Dr. Mona Hannah Atisha was one of the first people to raise alarm bells about elevated blood lead levels in Flint's kids. She's been following their health and development ever since. Now, early results from neuropsychological assessments give us a more in-depth picture of the challenges some Flint kids are facing. Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha shared those results with CBS's 60 Minutes last night, and she joins us by Skype now. Dr. Mona, welcome back to Stateside.
April, it's always great to be with you.
More than 170 kids in Flint were given these in-depth neuropsychological assessments, looking at behavior and developmental issues. How long have you been following these kids?
So this is part of our broad work to really try to answer the question of how are Flint kids doing? I think that's the most common question I get asked wherever I go is like, how's it going? How are the kids doing? How are the people of Flint doing? So real quickly after the water crisis happened, we set up the Flint Registry to do this objective data-driven work to survey not only children, but adults to see how they're doing. And most importantly, to get them connected to the resources to mitigate the impact of what happened in Flint. We've been able to refer about 6,000 people to critical services like neurodevelopmental assessments, like early education, like Medicaid and healthcare services. Our biggest referral for children has been to the Neurodevelopmental Center of Excellence. This is a new center that is led by Genesee Health System. And the numbers that were shared at 60 Minutes came from that center. We referred over probably 1,200 kids just from the registry to the Neurodevelopmental Center. And they are beginning to look at their numbers and the outcomes of those in-depth, like 8-hour assessments. And from the very, you know, from about the first 200 assessments that have been done, those results are quite sobering.
So of the children tested, how many are showing cognitive or developmental delays?
So about 174 children have been tested. And of those tested, about 80% of those kids show a need for additional services for language learning and intellectual concerns. There's a big caveat here. These first kids that went through this neurodevelopmental center, these kids were probably some of the highest risk kids who had some of the highest needs. So these numbers should not be seen as representative of the entire population. However, the more kids that enroll in the registry, the more kids that go through this Neurodevelopmental Center of Excellence, the better we'll be able to tell you how the population is doing.
What's the range of conditions that we're talking about here?
So the range is what you would expect from children exposed to this kind of crisis. You know, this crisis was a population level trauma. So we're seeing the effects of trauma. We're seeing the effects of potential lead exposure, but we're also seeing probably longstanding issues. You know, the Flint crisis happened on top of a community rattled with so many toxicities, you know, be it poverty, be it, you know, poor home environments and crumbling schools and violence and lack of nutrition. All of these things, science tells us, also impacts the development of children. So it's impossible for us to really prove causation to say, oh, these findings are because of the water crisis. Our goal from the very beginning was to see how kids are doing now and to get them into the services they need to make sure that they can thrive and recover. So the things that we are seeing are things like, learning issues, intellectual issues, speech problems, the need for, occupational services and speech services and behavioral health services, treatment recommendations for things like attention disorder. So kind of a wide range of neurodevelopmental issues.
Can I ask how intervention might work for these children if a full intervention for all the kids that we're talking about can happen?
So that has been our work from the very beginning. So when you have something like lead exposure, what you're supposed to do is practice something called primary prevention, which in the world of public health is never exposing the population to something like lead because we know it has this profound neurotoxicity. However, there's a lot that we can do that can mitigate, buffer, limit the impact of this crisis and promote the health and development of children. And that's what we've been doing in Flint from the very beginning. So things that we have been able to put in place that can, you know, help are things like high quality early child care, massive expansion of early literacy. This is one of my favorite things in Flint. You know, we don't have enough children's books and we have significant problems with literacy. So as a community, we came together, created something called Flint Kids Read. Every kid in Flint now gets a book mailed to their house every month from the age of 0 to 5. I think 150,000 books have been mailed to Flint kids. We've expanded healthcare access. So kids have more access to things things like developmental screening and visits with their medical home, nutrition services like our nutrition prescription program, expansion of WIC. So there's a lot that can be done, interventions that can be done to limit the consequences. And even when these consequences are identified, to get kids very as early as possible into the necessary services like speech therapy and healthcare services and special education services to limit the impact of what we may see.
Is a clinical intervention necessary for all of the cases that you looked at?
No, absolutely not. So, you know, some kids would benefit from, for example, therapy services and maybe medication. But a lot of these kids that are being assessed through the Neurodevelopmental Center also need services at the school setting. So all of these recommendations are shared with the child's school. And it's often the school-based interventions that are the most important as well.
Flint schools have, over the past 5 years, seen a significant increase in the percentage of children in the district who need special education services. Those can be really expensive. What does a district that's already strapped financially do when so many kids need this kind of help?
Yeah, this really kind of highlights the crisis in our schools, the crisis of how we fund our schools as a state and really as a nation. Flint schools have lost significant numbers of students, and the funding goes with the students. And at the same time, there's this increased need for special education services. They may have also increased because we're actively, through this registry and the Neurodevelopmental Center, we're actively doing a better job finding kids who need help. So this definitely speaks for the need for increased support from not only the state level, but also the federal level to make sure that our children are being identified and getting into the services they need to recover.
Can I ask you for just a moment about current conditions in Flint?
Absolutely.
The kids that you studied alongside millions of other Michigan school children are at home for the foreseeable future. What are your thoughts about their situation right now?
Yeah, this obviously is an unprecedented crisis we're in right now. I'm at home right now with my two school-age children, and they're obviously not in class. They're not learning, and no matter how much we try to provide them with online or other enrichment activities, there is no replacement for being in school. So we're going to probably see a gap, an achievement gap. Time will tell, but it's going to impact our most underserved children the most. Our underserved kids, like kids in Flint, don't have the privilege of things like, you know, Wi-Fi and, you know, online classrooms and devices at home where they can get these additional enrichment services. So, you know, we will continue to advocate for them that during this period they have some of those educational opportunities, but it is very challenging right now.
What else do you feel like you wish you knew about these kids?
There's a lot that we're beginning to learn. And I think what I wish I could get right now is a better representative of how the entire population is doing. Like I said earlier, these are some of the very first children that have gone through these in-depth assessments. This is not representative of how all our Flint kids are doing. The kids I interact with in Flint every day are incredibly brilliant and brave and resilient, and they're absolute leaders. In my pediatric public health initiative, we have something called the Flint Youth Justice League. They're a group of kids who have been advising us and have been directing us and telling us what we should be doing. And they're actually even working with kids in Newark, New Jersey that are going through a very similar water crisis and giving them advice on how to be, you know, advocates and leaders and how to use their voice. Yeah, you know, we have ongoing issues in Flint. You know, that national media spotlight, you know, has faded, rightly so. There's lots of other things that we should be talking about. But our story is a long-term story, but it's also a story of amazing, amazing resilience, of resistance, but also incredible hope that's very much being led by our children.
Mona, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us about this.
Thank you. Stay safe.
Flint pediatrician Dr. Mona Hanna-Attisha. That's it for today's episode. We'll see you tomorrow. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.